Welcome to the InternetCases.com podcast. I'm attorney Evan Brown. This is part two of the audio from a talk given in Chicago on November 4th, 2005 by Cindy Cohen, the legal director and general counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This portion contains the question and answer session. The main talk was contained in part one, which was released as a podcast here on InternetCases.com on November 9th. Here now is the audio from the question and answer session.
I understand that there was clear evidence that Grokster was informing people to go ahead and copy and, you know, in essence, infringe. How do you deal with it? I mean, the impression I have now is, you know, I tell my clients, keep your mouth shut.
I think that's right. I think keep your mouth shut is a huge part of it. I think that the entertainment companies, and you know, you got to kind of take your hat off to them, did an amazing amount with an incredibly small amount of evidence. They had about a dozen email messages, and these are companies that have been around for a long time, where somebody had said, "I can't get this thing to work. How do I do it?" And they had a standard, the companies had a standard response that basically said, you know, install the latest version of Windows, you know, basic, like, you know, how do you make your computer program work on your system? And what the entertainment companies pointed out is that often in these requests for assistance, they said, I just downloaded The Little Mermaid and it won't play. What do I do? And if you said that to the company, you got an automatic response back that said, in order to make this product work, you should make sure you have the current version of Windows, you should make sure you have the current version of our software, you should do blah, 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 blah. So they got a standard stock answer back. And the entertainment company said, well, you know, when they got a message from someone saying, look, I downloaded The Little Mermaid and I want to play it, they shouldn't have responded. And so that's, you know, that's the evidence.
Wasn't there any positive statements made by Grokster?
There was one statement made by Grokster where somebody said, how come you don't have any Dylan? And somebody said, I think it was the Beatles, how come you don't have any Beatles? And there was a extremely snarky answer back from the, you know, customer support kid saying, well, why don't you load some up? So there was one message like that.
And was it?
There were maybe two more, but it wasn't very much. I mean, there was stuff.
It seemed to indicate that there was clear evidence that Grokster was pushing the idea of infringing.
Also in its comparisons to Napster, right? We're going to take over this.
That's what they said. They said they're trying to get the business of Napster, which had been an infringing business, was evidence of bad intent. And they did. I mean, they did that. They clearly did. I mean, Grokster, you know, I think that anybody who wants to start a company that ends in Ster now ought to be in big trouble. And I'm really worried about the hamsters. But there was. I mean, this is what the court pounced upon, was this stuff. And the entertainment companies did a tremendous job of taking little bits of evidence and making them seem significantly bigger than they were. But it's true that this occurred. I mean, I think that's why you got the inducement decision out of the case. Yeah. Because neither of those two things are particularly relevant to vicarious or contributory infringement, which is what we said.
Was there also clear evidence that Grokster could have technically prevented this?
No. I think that was a hotly disputed topic.
I think the court seemed to indicate that they could have.
And I think the court was wrong about that. Now remember, the court remanded. I mean, the court said, I mean, I think that the court went pretty far in actually saying what it thought the evidence showed, but at the end of the day, it remanded back to the district court to really look at this, and I think that we'll see, you know.
Was the evidence there or not?
No, it was hotly disputed. The filtering stuff doesn't work. I mean, it really doesn't. It didn't work in Napster, right? I mean, it didn't. I mean, that's why, you know, Judge Patel made the order that the filtering didn't work in Napster, and you know, the filtering hasn't gotten magically better in any significant ways. So it was a hotly disputed item. Again, our argument was based on this vicarious argument that could you have, you know, whether you could have designed it differently, whether you could have designed it. I mean, what the entertainment companies were saying, well, you built this decentralized system where people could share one-to-one. If you had instead built a centralized system where every transfer had to go back to a central place and be filtered and then go back before it could actually happen, then you would have had a system that would have better protected our rights. And our argument was decentralization is a tremendously important and powerful innovative tool, and to require as a design matter every single system that lets people share files to have some kind of centralized mothership that checks all transfers before they happen is a really it was a bad design decision, but it's also just not appropriate for the court to require a tech company to do. And so the argument was really about vicarious liability and whether this was even an appropriate question. And the Ninth Circuit, the district court, agreed with us that it wasn't an appropriate question. And the Ninth Circuit agreed with us that it was an appropriate question. So we got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, actually, I think it is an appropriate question under the question of inducement, and sent it back down again. So it was a disputed issue below, but fundamentally our argument was, you don't get to go into the design room and tell us we have to build a centralized system rather than a decentralized system.
But if you're in the business, an STER business, then why not require that kind of approach so that you don't infringe? It doesn't have to apply to all other kinds of file sharing when you're not, most other cases you're not using, obviously, copyrighted material.
Well, what other kinds of file sharing are you talking about?
I don't know. What kind?
Well, no, I mean, this is the fundamental question. There isn't. There's no magical way that you can have build a system that knows whether something's infringing or it's not. Files are files. Computer, it's bits. Ones and zeros are ones and zeros. There's no way. You have to build a system that will check absolutely every transfer from this computer to the other system. Because you don't know. Your IM client can transfer files. Your email program can transfer files.
Technical way of doing it.
Right. And what that would mean is your email I don't actually think there is one, but even if there was, does this mean that your email program, because you can attach an MP3 file to an email that you send just like any other things, that your email program ought to be redesigned so that before you get to send an email to anybody else, and that would include between you and your clients, it's going to check with some place in the sky, maybe managed by Microsoft, or maybe managed by Time Warner, or maybe by a company called Audible Magic that's trying to run one of these up, to make sure that that file that you've attached doesn't include a copyrighted work before you get to send your email. Well, that's what the entertainment company, that's the logical result of what they're saying.
Does it behoove each of our firms to, in fact, try and install something like that so that a member of my firm, his firm, do not get caught doing something like that?
Depends on whether you're inducing.
It's going to be copyrighted pretty much, whatever file you transfer. If it's anything written or if it's audio or...
Yeah, and this isn't just about movies and music, right? I mean, it's about books, so it's a text file. Any text file. I mean, does it behoove you? I think that it'd be hard to get an inducement theory because I don't think that anybody... I think that taking this argument to the point and trying to say that whoever wrote Microsoft Outlook intended that you could be able to use it may be a losing argument today. But if people started massively using Microsoft Outlook and the attach feature of every single email program to do infringement... And then we sent Microsoft a notice. Time Warner sends Microsoft a notice saying, we've discovered and we have evidence that 50% of your Outlook users are using Outlook to infringe. The principal use of Outlook is now to infringe, and therefore you are now on notice that you know that this product's being used for infringe, and you need to design it so there's a central mothership that checks to see where it's not. I'm not sure how that case will come out.
It would be perfect, because then you'd have two giants battling it out, and you could go to Supreme Court and get split away.
Well, maybe. I mean, this is the argument. This is why we had Intel and Microsoft and Apple on our side. I mean, they don't give a they don't care about these little companies, right? They recognize the logical import of this design decision piece of the argument that the entertainment companies and what that would mean for them and their products.
Yeah, the Breyer and the Ginsburg factions went in great lengths to articulate their respective positions, which they didn't have to do.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, are there any cases in the pipeline that are sort of getting ready to tee up in any way? No.
I don't think so. I mean, the only other case that was really moving, the only other case was Amster, which is a Seventh Circuit decision that Posner kind of went off on his little dicta about what he thought the basically saying he thought Betamax was wrongly decided in dicta, I think is a fair reading of what he said. But Amster wasn't, as a legal matter, inconsistent with Grokster. At least we argued that. They tried to argue there was a circuit split. I don't think the court came, again, because the court didn't address any of the primary issues that we'd litigated for 2 years. I don't know whether they thought there was a circuit split or not.
Which sort of moots my next question, which was if anybody was sort of reading the tea leaves on what the composite, with the Ginsburg and the, what that means, six justices. And has anybody been getting feedback on that?
Not really. I think it's too early to tell about Alito, for sure. I mean, he'd only done, like, one copyright case. I mean, we did some, the short answer is we've looked at both of Roberts and Alito about, and Myers, but, of course, there was nothing there, but about copyright issues. Roberts was on a panel in the RIAA versus Verizon case that had to do with statutory interpretation under part of the DMCA, and he interpreted the statute narrowly, which I don't think is a surprise to anybody who knows Roberts, but he did in that copyright case. But it wasn't really a copyright case in the kind of bigger copyright question matter. He has a smattering of other copyright cases, but I don't think they tell you very much. And Alito really doesn't either. He had one copyright case about the copyright ability, I think, of numbers or names or titles or something. And again, he made the right decision, which is that they're not copyrightable, but it wasn't a particularly hard question. So, again, I don't think we know very much about either one of them, except that at least in Roberts, in the questioning in the oral argument in the RIAA versus Verizon case, asked some pretty technically savvy questions. So I think that he doesn't appear to be a Luddite. It appears to be somebody who's got a good facility with technology and can ask hard questions. Again, probably not a surprise to anybody who looks at the rest of his judicial record, but that was our conclusion. That's about all I can say.
I think one of the things the court at least implicitly was concerned about was the massive numbers. How do you deal with that? If the old bright line and Sony standard is adopted, you have this problem of massive copy.
Yeah, it's a tough argument. I think you're right. I think that underneath all of the legal analysis, that's clearly what was concerning the court. I'm not sure how you deal with that as a matter of the product producer's liability, though. Because how do you know whether, you know, when you put a product out on the marketplace, whether 5 people are going to use it to fringe or 5 million people are going to use it to fringe? I mean, lots of technologies rolled out of the box with one kind of intended use by their creator and then since developed massively different uses. And there's no better example of that than the VCR, right? Because when the VCR rolled out, there weren't any video rental shops. So the VCR's main use, and I think you would look that right across Sony's internal memos, was to allow people to record TV at home and watch it later, which the entertainment companies argued at the time was a flat copyright infringement. And I think most copyright scholars agreed with them. But then, you know, the market shifted and changed, and now I think that home recording of TV probably isn't even remotely the primary use of most VCRs, and of course now we're into DVD players and stuff, but it's hard to know. I don't know what you do, but I just think that you can't hold that back on the technology creator, because there's no sane way for anybody to be able to, you know, figure out how the street's going to find uses for the product.
So I represent, let's say, a tech company, and I want to advise them about the development of software, and I send an email, or somebody in the company sends an email to somebody else that says, do you realize that this software that we are developing and intend to market could be used for copyright infringement? Would that be inducement?
Well, I think it would be the start of an inquiry into the whole rest of that, you know, what happened? What happened as a result of that first thing? And if the answer is, you know, yes, we know that it can be used for infringement, and we don't care, or, you know, isn't that cool? I plan to do a lot of infringing with it, which I think is what happened in the Napster case. Then I think you've got real problems. If the answer is, well, we're worried about that, but here's these 5 measures that we're taking in response, then I think you may have a start. Of course, the worry about this inducement argument is that the entertainment companies will come up with the 6th, 7th, and 8th and say, well, why didn't you do these 2? So I think, again, this is where I worry about this, and this is why I think you can't decide it on summary judgment. I think it's always going to be an issue of material fact about whether you did enough or not.
So the ultimate question, though, is really, why do you think the Supreme Court dodged the basic issue, upheld Sony 9-0 for differing reasons?
Yep.
But just dodged this whole question?
I think they were split. I think they were split about, I think that we got three and they got three, and we had three who didn't, you know, I don't know where they came out. I think they were split, and I think that they all felt together that these companies were dirty, and that there was this other doctrine out there that was presented by some of the amici. I mean, the entertainment companies didn't want the inducement argument either. They fought hard against it, and Don Verrilli of Jenner and Block argued that case, and I was there, and he said, that will not be enough for us. That will not solve our problem. Inducement liability won't solve our problem. They did not want it. I mean, after the decision came out, they all praised the court and now great and how this was a big victory for them. But they argued very strongly against inducement liability because they wanted contrib and vicarious construed their way. But I think that the court felt 9-0, that these guys were dirty and that there was this other doctrine that they could borrow from patent law that would get these clients without having them to deal with the thing that they were horribly split about, which is the two underlying doctrines. I think they just punted.
So you advise your client to keep her mouth shut about any possibility of copyright liability, and you do not induce. You can then develop software that is capable of substantial non-infringing use.
I think that's a fair reading of the thing. I mean, we'll only know when the courts start dealing with it. I mean, God knows, don't let me be the one who tells you the law on this, because I think time will tell. But that's my reading of this, is that the Betamax doctrine stayed intact. Now, we can still fight about what it means. And I think that there'll still be fight about what it means. But I think if you've got clear, substantial, non-infringing uses, and you don't have any evidence that there was any intent for people to use your product to infringe, then I think you're probably still in the clear, and that, you know, you don't have the right and ability to control what people do.
Until the next case.
I mean, that's where we are. I mean, again, this is why I'm sorry. I wish I was up here to say we took this case. You know, even if I could stand up here and say, look, we took this court to the case to the Supreme Court. We did our best to get a clear, bright-line rule in favor of the tech industry, and we ended up with a clear, bright-line rule in favor of the content industry. Doesn't that suck? I could tell you that, but we didn't, right? We ended up with it. We went to the court with two questions, and we came out with 2.5. The same two, plus I think some questions about, there are some questions about what inducement means. I don't know what to say. You know, that's showbiz, right? I mean, that's just what happens. You take it to the big show at the, you know, up there in that beautiful building in Washington, D.C., and you get what you get when you come back out.
So it's a perfect time for Congress to step in. Is anything substantial actually happening in Congress?
Well, there are some things happening in Congress. There have been some hearings. Unfortunately, what's happening in Congress is not any relief for the tech companies. It's the entertainment industries coming back in and saying the Supreme Court didn't give us what you wanted and you need to give us even more, Congress. And frankly, in this Congress, I'm not sure I'd sell them out. I would count them out just yet. I mean, the tech industry is not as efficient on Capitol Hill as the content industry is. They don't have the long history of relationships on Capitol Hill that the content industry does. And frankly, while I think they're concerned about this, I think it'll take a few more cases and some fallout from this and see which way it goes before I think they'll get mobilized to really even put a full court press on Congress. I think that there's, you know, I think there's probably sufficient, well, we'll see. I mean, I hate to, you know, as bad as it is to read the tea leaves on the courts, it's even worse to try to read it on Congress. But I think that, I mean, I think that the sense, at least immediately after the Grokster decision, was that Congress didn't have to act now because the Supreme Court had basically given the industry a way to go after the bad actors with this new inducement theory, and that would, you know, they would see how that went, and then make the content industry only come back to them if they said, really, this inducement thing didn't do enough for us. But we'll see. They may be able to pull some stuff out. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things going on. It's a bit of a whack-a-mole game for us to try to figure out all the places that the content industry are trying to come forward with various different propositions in Congress. They've gotten a lot of money now to the Justice Department to do criminal copyright infringement stuff, and there's a whole new task force that's been set up, and that's one of the things that they got, you know, that they got put together. And they also tightened up some of the penalties and stuff on some of the other things. There's a camcorder bill that got passed and some other things. So there's a lot of things going on in Congress. But I think on the main event, I hope anyway that I think that Congress may wait and see as well, just like the rest of us, about what the fallout of this is and whether there are really big problems or whether it really sorts itself out. Is there anything else?
Cindy, this is not the first time that there's been a real tension between content producers and whomever else. You know, we can go all the way back to the player piano and then back in the 70s when cassette tapes were more available and people could copy phonograph records and things like that. Are you able to comment really on the uniqueness of this tension, this new tension that we have in the digital age versus those historical instances?
I think that's right. I mean, I look at this as just the same old battle that we're having over and over and over again. Every time there's a new technological innovation, the content industry, you know, thinks that the sky is falling. And, you know, they work themselves out in different ways. In the VCR case, for instance, the court said, no, you don't get to kill this technology. And then the industry went to Congress, and Congress said, no, you don't get to kill this technology. And so they came up with the video rental market, and they make more money now off video rentals than they ever... You know, than they do on movies now. In other instances, there's been compulsory licensing or the voluntary collective licensing schemes or other kinds of things. In the case of digital audio recorders, there was the Audio Home Recording Act that had a levy system. So the Congress, you know, we've responded as a policy matter in different sorts of ways. I don't think we've ever banned technologies, though, which is what they really want. So they've always gotten a little something, but never what they completely wanted. The thing that is, I think, somewhat different about this is the scope of technologies that are now at risk from this doctrine. I mean, a VCR was kind of a discrete thing, and it did kind of a discrete thing. But now, again, back to my point about computers and their ability to copy in so many different ways, that the range of technologies and the range of innovation now that becomes suddenly involved in copyright law is really huge. It's really much bigger than I think that I've ever, you know, again, I don't claim to be a historian, but very different than the world. And it's because these, you know, because computers, I mean, this is one of the, you know, computers are multi-purpose devices. They're general purpose devices. And so the same computer that can make copies easily can do all sorts of things. And in each of those instances now, I think copyright law becomes implicated in ways. And so it becomes a bigger question. It's not just about the VCR anymore. It's not just about file sharing programs anymore. It's about any program that could be used to copy. And while that was a small number with analog technologies, it's a huge number for digital technologies.
You have to add to that the consolidation of the content industry,
yeah,
and their ability to use technology to control content.
Yes. Well, and this is an old fight, too. I mean, the content industry has always tried to control the platform for their works, right? I mean, the patent cases about movie projectors are like that. And so now they actually may. I think that, you know, there's another fight brewing that EFF's in the middle of about the broadcast flag, where the content industry is trying to require every technology company to build technology such that they will, that the content will come with instructions about what you can do with the content that will be restrictive or, you know, limiting in what the consumer can do. And it won't just be a licensing matter such that the consumer is constricted, and it won't just be a copyright matter, which, you know, copyright says what you can and can't do with works. It'll now be as a technological matter. Your technology will have to respond to that flag and limit what you can do with these works that you've bought without any, you know, it'll just be without outside of your control. And one of the main things they want to do is kill digital outputs, so that if you get a movie, you know, say you record a movie off of TV, you're not going to be able to move it from that device that you recorded it on, say, to another device. So, you know, recently, EFF, we're all a bunch of nerds, and we've been watching Battlestar Galactica, and somebody recorded one of the last season, the season ender of Battlestar Galactica, and we wanted to go watch it over at my house because I have a big screen projector, but it was on the TiVo that, you know, my client, that my colleague had, and you know, he was able to move it to a VCR, and we were able to do it. But in the new digital technology, you know, if they get their way, you won't be able to do that.
You had a bias in the Groxman case.
I did.
And I'm just curious, personally, about whether you think that the content industry in that case, and in the Napster case, which I'm sure you're familiar with,
oh, yeah,
in the movie, and in other cases brought by the content industry, exaggerate their statistics. What I really mean is, I read an article the other day about, in connection with the reasons for the DUE Act that prohibits anybody taking a VCR, taking a camcorder into a motion picture theater for the purpose of recording a movie on the screen. And the statistics that I read said that this particular movie, a very recent one, opened at midnight in this one theater. Somebody went in with a camcorder, recorded it, and by 7 o'clock in the morning, there were like 500,000 illegal copies out in the marketplace. And I don't know, it seemed jarring to me that that statistic would be true.
Yeah, I find it kind of jarring as well, although it is the case that some of the file trading systems, like BitTorrent, will automatically make a copy when you're downloading. So it may be that there aren't 500,000 people who wanted that movie in the first 7 hours, but the way the system worked, there may have been more copies. And I think 500,000 still sounds high, but it may be as a side effect of some of the file trading programs that are used that more copies are made than actually people really want to see. But certainly, I mean, one of the briefs that I helped wrangle in the Grokster brief was one by a Harvard business professor and another professor, I think, at North Carolina, Oberholzer and Strumpf, wrote a paper about file trading that has been very, you know, well peer-reviewed, that said that they are the industry, that there's no evidence the industry's been hurt at all by file trading. Certainly, the amount of music for the record industry, the amount of music that has been traded in the file sharing systems is consistent if you control for inflation and you control for, you know, the general market downturn, you know, in the late 90s. Most of what they claim as a loss in revenues due to file trading goes away. The market, the actual just downturn in the market and the purchasing across the board will take care of a huge amount of what they claim to be lost profits due to this. They also claim that every file traded is a lost purchase, which I think is as people who are social scientists who actually look at this from a scientist perspective say that's a pretty hard proposition to support as an empirical matter. So I think they have a hard time showing there. And then, of course, for the movie industry, they've had record profits for the last 5 years. I mean, year upon year upon year. So I don't know, you know, what is it that they're, you know, and, you know, so they're forced to argue, well, we would have made even more money if it hadn't been for file trading. And I think that's kind of a hard argument. But I think that their numbers across the board on all sorts of issues like this, I think, are highly suspect. One of the problems we have with them about things like sales and stuff is that they guard that data really close to their vest, and they only give you the slices of it that support their argument, and they won't give you the full range of it. I mean, I know this because we've worked with researchers who've tried to do a really more thorough analysis of the entertainment industry's numbers, and for instance, they never report foreign movie sales. You'll never get a raw number for them out of their foreign movie sales, and you never get a really good number out of them out of their profit for movies. I mean, as you know, this, if you watch Hollywood, I mean, trying to figure out whether a movie actually made money in any kind of objective way, you never know. So then how do they come up with, you know, we lost $5.4 billion in profit for this, when they won't even tell you what their profit on one movie is? How can you even begin to think about whether they're right about these numbers?
They call that the Paramount system.
Exactly. I mean, one of my co-counsels in the early days of the Streamcast case is a firm down in LA that's what they do. You know, mainstream is they represent artists and directors and other people who are trying to get their share of the profits of a movie that they have under contract. And he's got some great stories about their accounting methods that are really very fun. But I think it's hard to take their numbers at face value, and they certainly don't give anybody the information that they would need to be able to double check their numbers at face value. Now, there are people who know what's going on peer-to-peer networks, and you can get good information about what's actually happening on most peer-to-peer networks. There are two companies that are really, very respectful. One of them is called Big Champagne. So if you really want to know what's going on in peer-to-peer networks, Big Champagne is the company that's actually used by the entertainment industry to figure out what's being traded. And it's also the source for the Billboard. You know, you can, when you go to Billboard magazine, you can get the top 10 file traded songs. That's Big Champagne's numbers. So don't take my word for it. Take the entertainment industry's word for it. They know what's going on. There's another little company called BayTSP that actually serves as the company that works for the movie industry in identifying file sharers for them to sue. So again, they're not on my side of this debate at all, but I know the folks at BayTSP, and we've talked with them a lot, and they're real techs. They're real people. There's a guy named Mark Ishikawa there who I have a lot of respect for as a technologist, and I often tell him, look, when the time comes that you want to come into the light, come over. You. There's a great job for you in a voluntary collective licensing scheme trying to figure out how much money to pay people because you know what's going on in the networks, and so you can say that Britney Spears song was traded 20 million times, and so X amount of money should go to her record label for that. I mean, there's a real job for people like that, even under any other scheme. And so, again, while they're not on my side of the debate, they're people who I respect if you really want to know what numbers are. And we have some BayTSP numbers. I think we have Big Champagne numbers in that report because one of the things that we point out is that despite all the hoopla about peer-to-peer file sharing networks and despite them suing everybody that they can out of existence and suing now 15,000 ordinary people, the number of people using file sharing systems continues and consistently goes up and has. So at the end of the day, you know, are we winning? Are we losing this battle? It's a hard thing to argue. I mean, as a legal matter, I think things are not going all so well for us. As a congressional matter, things aren't going so well for us. But you know, this isn't something that I'm doing. I mean, all EFF is trying to do is say, look, 60 million people or however, 8 million people at any given time, as I don't remember what the numbers are on file sharing networks. That's not going down. It's going up. So we have to, as a country, I think, and as a world, it's an international problem, figure out how to deal with this in a way that's better than the way that we're dealing with it now. They're not going to make this go away. They can sue every single company out of existence. A college freshman wrote Napster in 3 weekends. There are college freshmen in this town of Chicago. I bet there are 10,000 people in the town of Chicago who could write a peer-to-peer file sharing system tonight. And believe me, if you think there are 10,000 in Chicago, there are hundreds of thousands around the world. They're never going to be able to stop this. There's a great paper by Microsoft technologists called, if you want to Google on, Microsoft Darknet. This is a paper Microsoft is not very officially happy about, but it's their text explaining why you'll never end peer-to-peer, while copyright infringement will always go on the internet and there's no way to kill it. And I think they're right as a technical matter. So then to me the question is, what are we going to do about this? Our voluntary collective licensing scheme tries to take what people are going to do anyway and harness it in a way that makes money for the industry and that also gets people out of this cloud. You know, 60 million people, again, they call them criminals. I call them voters. You know, we have to find a system that doesn't make everybody, you know, criminals for doing what they're just going to do anyway. There are other ways to get artists paid. And that's what we ought to focus on. How do we get artists paid in this new world? Rather than, you know, do we throw rocks at people? Do we say there's moral laxity? Do we say what's the matter with kids today? I just think that's kind of useless. I think we got to figure out how to harness this, make money for artists, and then let the technology roll.
I was curious if the EFF had a position on the spoofing activity that the music industry supports, where peer-to-peer users to be copyrighted works, in fact, turn out when they try and open them after wasting time downloading them, spoofed or empty files.
I think, as a legal matter, there's not anything illegal going on. I think it's troubling. I think just like the suits against file shares, it's just another step down a really bad road. You know, rather than really trying to deal with the problem, it's really an attempt to try to pollute the networks. And I just don't think it's very useful. It actually came back to haunt them in the Canadian case. You know, there was a case against where the Canadian version of the RIAA, which CRIA, CREA. Tried to get names of end users from Canadian ISPs. And in that decision, the court took CREA to task because all they said was, here are these files, this is our file name, this is our song that we own the rights to, so therefore this person must be creating copyright infringement. And the court said, well, you know, there's evidence in the record that you guys spoof. That you guys put songs out there, things out there that look exactly like your songs, but aren't the songs at all. So you haven't made a threshold showing to us that that because this is your name, it's actually your song. Because you yourself are putting things out there that look exactly like your song and aren't. So as a threshold matter of pleading, you haven't met your burden to demonstrate the copyright infringements going on here. I'd love to see that argument raised in one of the U.S. cases, but it worked in the Canadian court. So, I mean, I have real trouble with one of the things they've done with their new, with their copyrighted CDs now, with the copy protected CDs, where now they're, if you put a copy protected CD into your computer, it actually launches, puts programs onto your hard drive that are hidden, that control your ability to do various things and actually disable your CD burner, your CD burner and stuff like that while you're doing it. And I think that's actually a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I think that's actually a trespass on your computer. So I think that's over the line. The spoofing, I haven't yet heard a legal argument that it's illegal. I just think it's a really dumb idea.
In your paper, you look at the argument that the recording industry activity against individual end users had the effect really of making it possible for the Apple iTunes success. And your paper sort of debunks that and says not at all. I wonder myself how the legal industry downloading alternatives will unfold. Certainly there continues to be almost every week in the papers activity as companies figure out whether they're cable companies or telephone companies, how to expand the competition for Apple in this area. So I wouldn't be pessimistic myself as to how that unfolds over the next 5, 10, even 20 years.
I think it'll be an important sector. I mean, I think that there are people like me, for instance, who, this is a conversation I had with a college friend where he said, well, how do these kids have time to be on these peer-to-peer networks and downloading and spoofing? And I said, well, do you remember when we used to go over to each other's houses and spend hours while we taped each other's albums, you know? You got a lot more time at a certain age than you do at an older age. I like the convenience of a 90, and I have EFF pays me, not a lot, but enough so I can afford a 99-cent download. And so I like that system. I'm also a Macintosh user, and it's really slick and easy. But so I think there's always going to be a place for those markets. I don't think they're going to go away. I just think it's important to keep, the fact that Apple issues press releases and other people issues press releases as they're developing their product shouldn't kind of keep our eye off the ball of the real numbers here. And, there's orders of magnitude more sharing going on the file trading networks than is going on the commercial things. And again, the commercial file trading networks aren't going down. I mean, the open networks aren't reducing in number as these new commercial products come online. So I think there's a niche for them, and it may end up being a pretty significant niche. I just don't think that we can be kind of bamboozled into thinking that that's changing anything in any dramatic way in the open networks, because it's just as a matter of numbers, it's just not. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to them. EFF's never been opposed to the commercial systems. I mean, we have a hard time with some of the DRM systems, and we think people ought to be aware of the limitations of what you can do with those. I think that a lot of people aren't aware that when you download a song from a lot of these networks, you really aren't. You don't own it. You're renting it. And when you stop paying your monthly fee, it just disappears. Or when you upgrade to a new computer, it's really hard to move your music collection from one to another. Apple's getting a little better about that, but some of the other ones don't even contemplate the idea that you might have a system crash, or that you might need to upgrade, or that you might have a virus and you might need to actually reformat and recreate everything on your hard drive. And I think that people, as they begin using some of these really locked down systems, are going to recognize some of the limitations of them. Or that you get a system on one system and you can't play it on another. MP3s play on everything. But the Apple AAC format won't play on your, Sony drive, and the Sony won't play on your Apple. And so it adds a level of complexity to most people's lives. And, when grandma buys you an MP3 player, but it won't work because your PC doesn't, have your files on it in that program, which, is not something I made up. It happened to a good friend of mine. If you begin to recognize the difference between lockdown systems and open systems and the limitations that they have on you, and we think people ought to be aware of that. Anything else?
Any other questions?
Great.
Cindy, thank you very much.
have enjoyed hearing you.